Today on the Scott Radley Show on 900 CHML.
A couple weeks ago, I wrote a piece for The Spectator talking about what I thought was going to be, and I still do, think is going to be the outcome of City Hall's conversion of Main Street and then the blocking of King Street for the LRT and then the blocking of part of Dundurn Street. I think it's going to cause unbelievable traffic problems downtown. Well, not everyone shares the view, and that's part of the beauty of being able to have opinions. There was a piece in The Spectator on Saturday, written by my next guest, LRT and Main Street changes will transform Hamilton for the better. It argues, and I don't want to take words out of her mouth, she's going to get a chance for sure. It argues that no, this is actually going to help, and counterintuitively, these changes will reduce traffic, will make more people walk and bicycle, and therefore it'll be better. I wanted to have her on because I want to have the chat because I think it's really interesting. Her name is Dr. Leah Ravensbergen. She's an assistant professor in the School of Earth, Environment, and Society at McMaster University. She joins us now. Thank you for joining me.
Hello. Hi, Scott. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, you know what? I love doing this, and we can agree to disagree on this one, but take a minute and explain why you think when the city whittles the number of lanes, and we don't know yet how many lanes they're going to whittle it by, but whatever, when they whittle Main Street, why that would actually make traffic not bottle up and work better.
Yeah, totally. What I really liked actually about your article is that your column is that you focused on congestion. And when a lot of people talk about the conversions, they don't even talk about congestion, which is what they're really worried about. And I was really glad to be able to respond to that specifically. I think we have to keep in mind also, and this is something I didn't have a chance to talk about in the original piece, in my response, that Hamilton's growing very quickly. Lots of new people are coming to the city. And as it grows in its current state, it's quite car dependent. It's actually quite hard to get around in any other mode of transport other than cars. And if all of these new residents keep driving their cars or bringing new cars into the city, your concerns of a permagrid, if anything, are more likely than if we actually provide other options for people to get around. So I tried to introduce in my piece two things that might seem counterintuitive, but that we find in research on what happens when we make it easier or harder to drive cars in cities. One of them, of course, is induced demand. This is an idea that's been around since the 60s. We've seen plenty of evidence across the US and Canada and all over the world, where if you make it easier for people to drive, if you add lanes, you only get less congestion for a short amount of time. A most recent systematic review looking across the US found that you only get about 5 years out of that before you get the same amount of cars back on the street because it's become easier to drive, so more people drive. And then the opposite is true. If you make it harder to drive, and easier to use other ways of getting around that are far more space efficient, like using transit or walking or cycling, you can actually reduce congestion, which seems very counterintuitive, but it is what we're hoping to see here in Hamilton and what the evidence points towards in the research.
And you know what? I don't know that it seems as counterintuitive as you say. The challenge, though, that I look at when I see Hamilton is the geography of it. And if this was merely the downtown population, I would say I would agree with you 100% that when lanes are reduced and cars aren't as convenient, people downtown will walk and will bicycle and will probably take public transit. The difficult part is we're not just a downtown. We have Dundas and Waterdown and Flamborough and Stony Creek and the mountain. And I can't tell you how many people I've heard from since writing this who have said, I'm just not going to come down. So we could end up whittling the traffic, but that's at the cost of making the city not accessible to those on the outside. I don't know if that's a victory.
Well, I have two responses to that. The
sure.
First is, I see this as a first step. You know, the lower city, of course, is getting a lot of priority, and I can see people sometimes wish, you know, hey, can't we have more improvements and changes happen in other parts of the city? And I go, absolutely. I really hope this is the beginning and that we'll have a more connected transit system across the city in the years to come, so that even if you're on the mountain or in Waterdown or in Ancaster, you can still come to the lower city using these other options. But also this idea that, oh, I'm just not going to go downtown anymore. Well, there's going to be a lot less traffic from those who already live downtown. So if the people downtown like me aren't in their car anymore, that means that there's one less car on the road because I'm on a different form of transportation. So there will be reductions in that way. But there's also a lot of potential for downtown to have even more reasons to draw you in, to make you come in, because we'll have a lot more things that can be grow in the downtown area when main parts of the city aren't really seen as a space to move vehicles, but as a space to move people and to have things like businesses and shops and places for people to convene along these major corridors.
Do you think that is your contention then that we will have essentially the same level of traffic with just lesser lanes, but it'll move at the same speed, or we will have less traffic and it'll move even quicker?
Well, this is where you need a traffic engineer to come in and do all of their predictive models. It's really hard, like I say in the piece, to know exactly what's going to happen. What I really caution against, though, is people assuming that what's going to happen is you're going to have the same amount of people that drive as they do now, except you'll have less lanes. You'll have a really big shift, or you really anticipate a big shift towards people using these other modes of transport. I'll use an example, a study of the LRT in Salt Lake City. This is a city that's even smaller than Hamilton. When they put in their LRT, they found that traffic on that road, on those routes, decreased by between 7,500 to 21,000 rides because of this availability of this alternative way of getting around. So we really are expecting this decrease in lanes, but also increase of people moving in far more efficient ways of moving around the city.
Let me throw one other one at you here, because there's one other wrinkle. I won't call it a glitch. I'll call it a wrinkle in what we're talking about, which is, again, even if I am to say, you know what, I will go along and say, yes, more people in the city will use transit or will bicycle or whatever. Even if I was to concede that, and I'm not doing that yet, but even if I was, that area, that
I don't have you yet.
not just yet, but that area along Main Street, especially when it comes to Dundurn, traffic numbers say that area holds more traffic every day than the link heading the same direction. So it's a very busy area, but a big part of that is that we have two highway ramps. So that is the main entryway to the city for a lot of people coming from Burlington and a lot of people coming down the mountain. Those people who are coming from out of town, though, even if they wanted to, those public transit or bicycling or walking options don't exist. So we're bringing all kinds of people who don't even necessarily have the option into that spot, which makes it different than a lot of other places.
Absolutely. And certain parts of how to do this right, like that's the conversation that I'm excited to have. It's not about whether or not this is a good thing. It's how to do it right. How do we get the most out of these changes? How do we make sure that these tricky parts are done in the best way? And there's lots of wonderful work out there on how to do this right. There's also showing that emphasis that we need to get better links between the lower city and other parts of the region that I mentioned earlier. This is really just a first step in the grander scheme of what needs to happen. And I would also add that, again, a lot of those people that are going through those busy links don't necessarily need to be going through those busy links if they can use other modes of transportation to get through them. And that needs to be part of the conversation about how to do this right. And I'm really excited, again, to get into that part and away from just the fear around whether we should do it or not and get into how to do it right.
All right. I am really tough on time, but you've said three times now something that I got to ask you about. You've said if they do it right. You've probably watched the meetings, you've seen the presentations. Are they heading down a path that is doing it right, or is this going to make things not so right?
I hope so. I hope they do. I'm excited about the push behind this. I think it's happening too late. I think we're all, once it's finally done, we're going to look back and wish it was done 10 or 15 or even 30 years ago. But I hope it's going in the right direction, and I'm excited to see what happens as it unfolds.
That is Dr. Leah Ravensbergen. She's an assistant, Ravensbergen, I got to say that right. She's an assistant professor in the School of Earth, Environment, and Society at McMaster University, and you can read her piece, go online. The headline, LRT and Main Street Changes Will Transform Hamilton for the Better. You can go read that, and you can then decide which, if you agree with her, if you agree with me, or maybe something in between. I don't know, but everyone gets to have their opinion. That's the beauty of this whole thing. Doctor, thank you for doing this.
Thanks so much for having me.
You're listening to the Scott Radley Show podcast on 900 CHML.
I've been seeing some posts online about just incredible lineups and demand for jobs now, which kind of surprised me because, as I said a few moments ago, I thought we were in a period where companies were desperate for people and couldn't find workers. But apparently for some jobs anyway, there is enormous demand. And that leads to this next story, because I was reading this piece online, fastcompany.com. They were referring to a survey that was done of people who filled out resumes. And they asked, hey, do you ever lie on your resume? 70% of workers say they've lied on their resumes. 37% say they lie frequently. But who is it who does the most fibbing on their surveys? Take a guess before I tell you the answer. You think it's people at the lower end jobs, medium jobs, or high end jobs? Well, it is the people with advanced degrees who are the ones who are doing most of the making stuff up. Are we surprised by this? I don't know. Dr. Anita Chinzer is Associate Professor of Leadership and Organizational Management with the University of Guelph. She joins us now. Doctor, thanks for doing this.
Hi, what a loaded cannon we're opening up today.
Well, are you surprised? Okay, before we get into the whys and all the rest of the stuff, if I had said to you without seeing this, which group, like high degrees, medium degrees, no degrees, who do you think was making it up most? Would you have guessed right?
I do think that I would have guessed this, but I mean, I'm also looking at lies in terms of, you know, there's degrees of lying.
Sure.
I'm not necessarily looking at blatant manipulation. I'm looking at, you know, what is the underlying systemic issue that's causing some of the higher educated people to lie. Let me give you an example.
Yeah.
We know immigrants come in with advanced degrees. We know that their education and foreign experience is not being qualified at equal levels. They're more likely to lie on their resume to actually downgrade their degree, or they can't get a job without Canadian experience. So to say that they worked for a friend's company or something along that way in order to get that experience. So they're lying to downgrade their education and fibbing about some of the Canadian experience they have because systemically they're stuck. They can't get a job without these conditions being met. So I'm looking at like the deeper issue around, you know, what does lying even mean? Who is doing the lying? But more importantly, why? Why are they lying?
And on the flip side, and that's a very valid point that I never even thought about. On the flip side, I suppose that some of those people with the advanced degrees are applying for incredibly competitive and lucrative positions. And so, you know, if I can just tweak it a little bit and make it sound a little bit better than it is, who knows, maybe I get in the door and they never check.
Possibly. So if we look at, again, let me look at the, you know, immigrant versus non-immigrant. If I have an advanced degree, I have a master's, let's say I have a master's in history, and then I'm applying for a job, but I'm now applying for something where that skill is not going to be needed, I might actually downgrade that. But we recently had examples too, where, you know, is it Veritas Software?
Right.
CEO? Right. The chief financial officer said that they had an MBA from Stanford and an accounting degree from Arizona State. But it was found through an anonymous email, like launched an internal investigation. It was found that they never actually completed those. And so he did resign from the company. But think about it. He got all the way up to CFO level before third-party screeners came in. And a lot of those people who have advanced degrees are actually saying, or who have been executives, are saying now that the headhunter embellished.
Oh.
They're saying, you know, the same thing happened in 2006. It was the Walmart, it was the chief spokesperson, David Tohar. He was hired in 2006. And in 2014, when he went up for another promotion, reference checkers found out that he didn't actually complete his degree from the University of Delaware. So he ended up actually, you know, having this lengthy discussion in the media. But he claimed that he didn't lie on his resume. The headhunters had embellished it because the headhunters are incentivized to find people who meet these check marks. And the headhunters are saying, wait a minute, this person's got great experience. They're advanced with their careers, but they just didn't ever finish that degree that they started. So let me just write down that they finished the degree. So sometimes we're seeing a lot, especially with, you know, the two examples I gave you, where they're saying it wasn't us, it was a headhunting firm who actually, you know, made the error. So there's some shifting of blame in regards to who with these advanced degrees and these, you know, more knowledge-oriented workers, who's actually scoping out the resume, who's creating the resume, who's verifying it.
And it's, you know, and it goes right to the top. I was reading something earlier today looking into this, and, you know, there are people who say Joe Biden, the president of the United States, has talked about being a full professor for 4 years. And they said, well, no, that's not really true. He was a full professor, but the time frame. So, you know, like, I guess anybody can add a little flourish to what they're doing does it matter? I mean, I guess we're getting into a really like gray area of lying here, although I don't think it's all that gray. But if you have got everything, if the essence of what you're saying is true, but you put a little flourish into it, is that a problem when it comes to filling out your resume or applying for a job that way?
So I think it's completely a problem. I do not support lying on resumes. I think it's completely a problem. What we've seen with those examples that I've told you, those people actually had to either resign or they were fired from their position. So it's considered a breach of trust, even if you've been employed with a company like David Tohar was for, you know, 8 years and working his way all the way up to chief spokesperson, he still had to resign because that was a bad faith relationship the whole time through. Mm. And what we know is when you tell one lie, people are stuck saying, well, what else is this person lying about? But let's take a look at what those results actually did say of the survey you're referring to.
Yep.
So they did say that most people, 52% embellished their responsibilities and 52% embellished their job title to make it sound more impressive. 45% fabricated how many people they managed and 37% lied about how long they'd been employed. Let's break these down. Those who were embellishing their responsibilities in general, those are the ones who were misleading. Right, because they're saying that I was able to lead this team, I co-authored this thing, I co-ran this thing, I launched this thing, but in reality, they didn't have the initiative or the leadership, and they're going to, for jobs that require initiative and leadership, and they're taking on someone else's strength, right? They're taking on the good responsibilities that someone else had and pretending that they're their own. I'd be the most worried about that. When it comes to job title, we know more than 50% of people in Canada, I think it's almost 70%, work for small organizations. And small organizations, job titles barely mean anything. You get hired onto a project manager, and then the next day you're doing marketing, and the third day you're involved with sales, right? So they're thinking, okay, well, what job title is going to best align with this new job that I'm applying for? So they do embellish job titles, but it's not necessarily faking the responsibilities. They're actually saying my job title was largely a mismatch for what I was doing.
Yeah, I suppose it gives away that you're looking for a job, but if I was working for a very small business, I would just say, hey, do you mind if we call my job this? I don't want a raise or anything. Just give me, can I have a nicer title? It just sets you up for down the road. You don't have to tell a falsehood about it, I suppose, but it does,
but you could be applying for three different jobs. If you work for a small company and you're doing product management and you're doing sales and you're doing marketing, you could be applying later on for jobs that involve any one of those three facets.
You mentioned about how people have lost their jobs years later, and you know I know they've used this line in court when they're talking about, you know, bad evidence that a police officer got or something and they shouldn't have got it. It's fruit from the poisonous tree, and so it's, you know, it's the same kind of thing. If you get a job based on a falsehood, it's your job is fruit from a poisonous tree. The whole thing is tainted. But do you think most companies, after they hire somebody, are actually going and doing the digging to find out? Or once that person is hired, for the most part, is it like, well, we're not even going to check anymore?
Yeah. So once that person's hired, usually they're not checking anymore. So doing your reference check prior to hiring the person. So before the job offer is given out, after the interview, when you've screened down to a handful of candidates, that's your time to verify. And so there's lots of reference checking companies out there. There are ones that look at social media as well. They take a look at online presence, you know, what your LinkedIn is. And the biggest issue that those checkers are finding is actually around the dates of employment. Mm. But then when we call people up and we ask them, hey, can you give us a reference person who worked for you? There's also a lot of lying there. So the person you're calling may not actually be the person who worked for them. And if you actually YouTube, you know, lying for a reference, you'll find some really creative people who have, you know, just called up a stranger and said, hey, I'm going to pretend that you're my boss. I gave you your number. Can you please, like, can you have my back and tell them that I was a great worker? So it takes a really good reference checker to find that. One of my ex-students actually had an exceptional company he started where it was all just reference checking before hiring. And one of his most important cases was he was actually trying to, there was a, you know, a multimillionaire who was in need of personal care, doctor care, physician care 24/7. And he was hiring an in-house physician and went down to the last candidate. And the last candidate was then, you know, hey, reference checking company, can you check this last candidate? I'm going to hire them on as a physician. Turns out that person had no medical background whatsoever. So people are faking all the way to that step. And you don't want to get to the step where you're like, oh no, I've already made the offer. I didn't do the reference check. But if you do have suspicions, go and get your references checked. Check the dates.
Dr. Nina Chinzer, Associate Professor of Leadership and Organizational Management at the University of Guelph. Thanks for doing this.
Have a great day.
You're listening to the Scott Radley Show podcast on 900 CHML.
Let me bring in Don Robertson. He is the guy who runs ComChoice Realty, and he is the guy who runs the Dundas Real McCoys. If you're driving up Osler out of Dundas, you'll see his big billboard these days for the Allen Cup that's coming up. He announced that last week here on the show. That's and the his league, his Real McCoys, along with the other teams in their playoffs right now. A lot going on for you right now.
It's a busy time, and real estate's starting to ramp up quite a bit, too. So back to 16-hour days. But it's okay. It's better than sitting around watching Oprah. It's
is that what you do when you're not – is that the choice? It's either work or watch Oprah? There's no other
– I think Oprah's off now, so it's probably a bad comparison. But yeah, it is busy, and we've got a lot to do to get ready for the Allen Cup, and things are coming together. And the opening ceremonies are a big deal, right? I mean, we have – the provincial flags for Alberta and flag bearers and, you know, it's just the whole opening ceremony takes on a life of its own. And of course the schedule and, you know, now we've got it on CHTV and Cable 14's doing that and the semifinals. So yeah, there's a lot to coordinate, but it's good for our community. And if it's good for our community, that's good for me.
Well, that's that right there is why you were the 2014 Dundas Citizen of the Year and leading candidate for the 2024 Dundas Citizen of the Year.
Yeah, I've started to buy ads.
That billboard, once the Allen Cup is over, it'll be Vote Don. This ad brought to you by unnamed sources. Mystery sponsors.
Yeah.
Not named ComChoice Realty, though maybe. you know, that is playoff hockey. And, you know, I was, Don, I was this week watching, it wasn't the Leafs. I was watching someone else a few minutes of a game. And, you know, I know we're not at the playoffs yet, but the commentators were making a point about whether their game is going to hold up for the playoffs. And it got me back thinking, I mean, we're heading to the playoffs soon enough. And the NHL, I think, is the only league, or hockey maybe, is the only sport where the rules seemingly entirely change when the playoffs roll around. In football, the rules don't change. What you did in the regular season is the same in the postseason. Baseball, basketball, every other league, if you are a great team in the regular season, chances are you'll be a great team or a very good team in the playoffs. And the NHL and hockey in general seems to be the one that somehow a decent regular season team might be a great playoff team because of how different everything is, or vice versa. Is that the way hockey should be? I mean, you were an official, you've been a coach, you've been a general manager, or should hockey decide, you know, tradition, whatever, we got to call the game the same no matter what time of year it is?
Well, it's a combination of a lot of things, and you bring up a great point as usual. The intensity level goes up immensely. And we've talked about that over the years, that it would be difficult to play at that level all year.
Mm-hmm.
And there are teams that are built for the playoffs because they know how the playoffs are. And you hear people talk about Vegas being a heavy team. And so they don't have their cupboard stocked with Willie Nylander and Mitch Marner. You need that combination of skill. I've talked about it before. I didn't know I built hockey teams like Brian Burke likes to build hockey teams, because I was doing it before, long before he was a general manager in the NHL. But the team that we've built, the Dundas Real McCoys, is we've got some players signed that have coaching commitments, and we understand the level. Last year we played game one against Alberta, and they ran us out of the rink in the first period. And I wasn't 100% sure how we'd react until we went out and battled them hit for hit, probably the best game in the tournament. So we've kind of built a team like that this year, because the Allen Cup playoffs will be far different. Not so much because they'll be officiated different. It's just the intensity level. Every square inch matters,
mm-hmm.
and bigger, stronger, more physical players And we're blessed that our bigger, stronger physical players are also very skilled. I don't know if it will work this year because you got to play the games. But we've tried to position ourselves for playoff hockey and Allen Cup hockey. And that's what NHL teams try and do. They try and build. Your top six have to be your skill. They have to carry the ball. But the bottom six have to play hard, play tight. And the first and second line have to put up with far more physicality than they have all year.
But you know as well as I do, and look, I get the part about intensity and heavier hitting and whether you're willing to pay the price and all that stuff, but you know as well as I do that when the playoffs roll around, the bar for what is a penalty tends to change. It just does. And there are things that, I mean, the league even acknowledges it. The league directly acknowledges it because if a guy gets suspended in the playoffs, which is harder to get suspended in the playoffs, the penalty is less because they say, well, the games are more important. But just the fact that you're getting a less of a penalty, they've changed the rule for the playoff. They're saying we're officiating this, that's off ice, but we're officiating this differently. I say, this is not about one team or another. I mean, I think the Leafs are doomed this year regardless. I don't care. I mean, it's not about the Leafs. I think there's a lot of teams that you look at and you just say, oh, like Vegas, for example. Vegas is in danger of not even making the playoffs. They probably will. But if Vegas gets in and they have to play Vancouver in the opening round, is anyone betting on Vancouver in that one? Even though Vancouver is clearly this year has been the superior team, Are you betting on Vancouver in that one?
I think it'll be a learning experience for Vancouver to learn how they're going to have to play in the playoffs to be successful. You think back decades ago when the Islanders beat the Edmonton Oilers out.
Yes.
And Wayne Gretzky recalling walking by the Islanders dressing room after the game. And those guys had ice packs on every conceivable joint in their body. And you walk into the Edmonton room and there's no ice packs.
Mm-hmm.
And that's probably when a lot of them understood that there's a far bigger price to pay in the playoffs than there is in the regular season. And guys will block shots. I can tell you when Jay McKee, the coach of the Bulldogs, was playing for us in the Allen Cup in 2014, he probably blocked more shots than anybody in the tournament.
Including your goalie. Honestly, he did.
Yeah, he did. He stopped as many as Mole did. But Jay McKee led the NHL for a number of years and blocked shots. That's not a fun job.
Mm-hmm.
I said to him, how do you do it? He said, he's getting away. But he's not scared to get hit because he knows it helps the team. So when you see a guy like Jay McKee paying that price, it kind of elevates everybody else. Like if he played 787 games in the NHL and he's prepared to do that, who do I think I am? And I think you see that with different leadership groups in the National Hockey League when the guys that are all about winning will pay that extra price. And then your star players, your skill players, look at that and go, I guess I've got to start getting in the way and doing my part. And if you can get those guys to do it, you can be successful. But I think Vancouver will learn a very valuable lesson. They may prevail, they may not. That's why they play the games, right? And so it'll be interesting to see how they react.
There is, though, and you hear this all the time, and it comes up especially in the playoffs, the officials don't want to impact the outcome of the game. They don't want to be the reason for the outcome of the game. And that always, to me, is such a weird line, because if in the playoffs you're less inclined to call a penalty because you don't want to affect the outcome of the game, if the rules that have been called all year don't get called as the same in the playoffs, by not calling it, you're impacting the outcome of the game.
Well,
you're going to help the team that commits more fouls because you don't want to affect them, but the team that doesn't commit as many fouls but draws more penalties by not calling it because you don't want to impact it, you're impacting them.
What you will find happens, two things I can tell you, that every playoff series has a supervisor involved, and the supervisor will meet with both head coaches and management team prior to the series starting, and perhaps every game if necessary, and say, here is the standard we plan on calling in this series. So the coaches are certainly aware of it, and you don't see them losing their marbles on something that you would have thought should have been called but wasn't called but was called all during the regular season, because they're made aware of it. So maybe the National Hockey League feels that provides a better entertainment value for everybody to have a different standard. You say call it a different way. I'm as a referee, and having been in series like that when I was very young in Junior B playoffs, it's not really that you let up. You just change your standard. And the important thing is, and when referees say, I don't want to determine the outcome of the game, it's your standard is different. But your standard has to be consistent through the entire game. During the regular season, if it's in the third period and the home team's down 6-2, they're likely going to get a couple power play opportunities. You don't get free power play opportunities in the playoffs. The stakes are too high.
One other thing I would say, we're going to take a break. One other thing I would say that they don't do usually, I would love to see referees and linesmen, but referees in particular, assigned to an entire series, not moving them around from game to game. Because then you presumably would know after game one what the standard is going forward for the entire series, as opposed to guessing at the beginning of every game, what are we going to get today? We're putting in a new ref? All right, well, now we don't know exactly.
Well, if they move them around, that's news to me, because traditionally they have three sets of officials, and they're all going to get two games, and somebody might get a third game. So generally you get the crews that kind of work in that series and they don't bounce around. And then generally it's the guy that's deemed to have done the best job in his two games. That will probably determine who's going to get game seven. But they used to get, you know, one, two, three, and so they would go through that way. But they weren't beyond changing it if one guy just had two stellar jobs and both coaches are saying, I don't care how you do this, make sure Bob Myers is doing game seven, even if he did game six. Now, you don't see that very often.
That's what I mean. They generally don't give the same guy over and over and over and over. You won't see the same two guys reffing every game in a seven-game series. That's what I'm saying.
In the old days, a guy could conceivably get four games.
Yes. Though. Yep. Yeah, I think it would be an interesting thing, and it would make it clear. It would clarify for both teams if we knew what the standard was right off the bat.
Well, not to make this about senior hockey, but last year in the semifinal, the two guys that refereed the semifinal game we were in refereed the final because they were deemed the best two in the tournament.
That's the way it should be. Mike Tyson, who is 57 years old, he is fighting against Jake Paul, who's a guy who's been fighting a few folks, mostly older, washed-up kind of guys, and Jake Paul wins all these fights, and he hits hard. There's no question that he's got some boxing talent. But July 20th, AT&T Stadium in Arlington, Texas, so I think that's the Cowboys facility, 110,000 people probably, and I bet they'll sell the tickets out to watch. Would you pay money to watch Mike Tyson at 57 years old box?
I would if I could be within 100 feet.
What about on TV? Would you pay like a pay-per-view, pay $50 to watch it?
No. No, I wouldn't. Because you'll see the highlights.
You'll see the highlights. You're right. But I think this is going to be an unbelievable moneymaker. I think Mike Tyson still is like Tiger Woods or like others that people really want to see what he can do. He's a fascination.
He's like going to a NASCAR race and only going for the crashes.
Yep. But there usually is one.
I don't know if an enigma is the right word, but he is certainly generational in his ability to captivate sports fans, hockey fans, mm-hmm. or hockey fans, boxing fans, and the
hockey fans too.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. The truth of it is he's a fascinating guy. And at 57, people want to say, what can he still do?
Have you seen any of the videos online of him training?
I did see a video on the weekend. I watched it twice. And he looks like he's 35 years old. Like his hands,
they're still moving.
Wow. And he's, and the guy he's in the ring with has like an armor, a suit of armor.
His trainer, yeah.
Rightfully so. But if he can, but it was like a 15 second video. And unless the rounds are only going to be 35 seconds, that may hurt him.
Well, see, that's the thing. I think that Mike Tyson, I mean, I'm quite convinced can still hit you really, really hard. It's a question of how at 50, actually, he says he's 58 here. So at 58, that may be, I don't know if that's now or if that's the time of the day of the fight, but anyway, they say 58. I don't know how much stamina he's going to have. I don't know if he's going to go more than two or three rounds. This may be one of those things where he goes out there and just lets it all loose in the first 2 minutes because that's all he's got. But if he catches him, watching those videos, I think he might be able to do some damage in those first 2 minutes.
He looks like he was in awfully good shape. Like wow. It's, no, I don't know what they do. I don't know. He doesn't have to worry about any drug testing. So I don't know if guys like that ramp up the steroids so that they look and get in super shape. I don't know. Don't care. I mean, do that to your body if you want to, but he looks in phenomenal shape for a man of that age. Now, you know, some of those superior athletes, they look good forever. I mean, they're always in shape. They're never seemingly overweight. And so he's pretty special.
There are guys who are up there in years, even in hockey. There are guys who could, you know, what Jaromir Jagr is, what, 51 now, 52? Yeah. Jaromir Jagr, who's still playing, is never going to play a full game at a high level for an NHL team now. But you could put Jaromir Jagr out for a power play, and for 2 minutes or a minute and a half or whatever, he could still do that two or three times a game, could still probably contribute. My point is, I don't think that Mike Tyson could, I know that unless physiologically he is the only person on the history of the planet ever to have this, he can't do what he did when he was in his 20s.
No, absolutely.
But for a minute or two, with the footwork that he has, which is unbelievable, and the experience he has and the knowledge he has and the hand speed that he still seems to have, for a minute or two, if I'm Jake Pauls, I am steering well clear for those first 2 minutes. Let him get tired and then go after him. But for those first 2 minutes, I would be very fearful.
Well, the other thing you always have to take into consideration with guys that have done things that he's done, never discount the adrenaline factor that can probably make him act like he's 38 years old or 28 years old. Those guys,
which is exhausting once the adrenaline dumps.
Right. He's got to finish it when that happens.
Yeah.
But you're right. If he blows it all in the first 2 minutes, well, it's not going to be as much fun to watch, but because there's no expectation you can keep a high energy level up at that age for a prolonged period of time. So if he can fake it enough and just do it in 30-second spurts and kind of wander around a little bit and stay out of trouble for a minute, he'll recover quickly.
The other thing is that if I'm Jake Paul, I don't care how cocky you want to be. You walk into the ring and stare across at Mike Tyson, I don't care how old he is, you're going to have some adrenaline of your own that's going to wear you out because you are... If you're not scared of what could happen to you, you're nuts. You're nuts. I don't know who has more to lose in this one. I mean, on the one hand, maybe Mike Tyson has just nothing to lose, which will be even better for him because he's just relaxed. Who expects a 57 or 58 year old to do anything?
Well, the guy he's fighting, my recommendation would be to slip on a pair of Depends before you go. But I remember Tyson. Everybody used to have an entourage, right? When they were fighting and the guy'd go in first and he'd have this great big long house coat or whatever the heck you call them. And Mike Tyson would walk into the
Liberace robe.
Yeah. Mike Tyson would walk in with one guy behind him, climb into the ring, no sweatshirt, nothing. Just walk in.
Black shorts, black shoes, and away he went. Yeah. The other.
It's just intimidating.
He is the most intimidating. And here, there's one other thing about this that I think people often lose. And I don't know what he can do now. I don't know. But I mean, I have to assume that Jake Paul, this guy, and you can look him up, has had some people looking into this to advise whether this is a good idea or not. and must know something, because there was a video online this week. There's a guy named John Jones who, he's sort of off again, on again, UFC heavyweight or light heavyweight champ. He's had some problems outside the cage, and so he's on again, off again. But this guy decided, you know what I want to do? I want to try something. I want to have John Jones deliver a leg kick. I want to see what it's like to get a leg kick from the champion. And he got hit twice. He let him kick him twice, and then he walked out on crutches with a massive hematoma to his quad and thigh. And I think that unless, and you've been around professional athletes, unless you have, it's because they don't look that special, because everybody around them playing the game at the same time is equal to or close to equal to. There's no, it's all relative. So there's no real comparison with an average goofball who's just decided to get on the ice. Like if you throw, with even the real McCoys, and I want to say even, that's not to disparage, but I mean, these guys are not, you know, they're mostly retired now. They're doing this part-time. You throw an average guy on the ice who's just played some rep hockey growing up and now is in a men's league. Suddenly you'll see how good the guys are who are on the ice. You throw this guy to get a kick in the leg from John Jones, suddenly you realize how hard those kicks are.
To use that analogy, Chris Campoli played almost 400 games in National Hockey League with Chicago and Ottawa, and plays with us. And earlier in the year, there was a young guy, big kid, went into the corner with him. I think he planned on running Campoli over, and like a big, strong kid. And about half a second later, Campoli's skating up the ice with the puck because they can turn and cut. Like these guys have never seen before and shift their body weight. Campoli's not like 6'2". He's, you know, he's well built. He's in great shape. But talking about giving a kid a lesson, to your point, you don't really know what you're up against a quality pro guy until you go in there. And this kid's going to find out what it's like to fight a former heavyweight champion, even if he's 57 years old, because Tyson will have tricks this kid has only ever seen on TV.
As long as Tyson doesn't get caught early, and I mean, he is an older guy, so you're not going to have the same ability to withstand stuff. You and I may have talked about this on the show. I have long said that the thing that CBC or CTV or NBC have missed, the one whiff they've made in Olympic coverage, is every time there's a swimming race or something, they should have just Joe Public swim bring him in, record him swimming as fast as he can that race. And you know how in the swimming, for example, they always have that line of where the world record is?
Yeah.
Superimpose, just put the average Joe as a ghost figure, you know, just like very almost transparent on the screen to show what he is doing compared to the Olympians, because when you're only competing against people of equal or close to equal ability who are all at the best in the world, it never looks impressive, because it's like being the same height as everyone in a room. No one, you don't realize that even if you fill a room with 7-footers, it doesn't look like anything because they're all 7 feet tall.
Yep.
There's no way to gauge against.
Your analogy, I think, and it was a few years ago we talked about it, was, so let's, and I'll use a different one. Let's take Max, track guy, the best at 100 meters, and put him against the Ben Johnsons of the world, the Donovan Baileys. Put him in that Ben Johnson race.
Yep.
And there's your marker to go, wow, that's the fastest kid at McMaster University. And that's not to disparage the fastest kid at McMaster University. No. But when somebody says, well, they're only going to be like a second and a half faster, well, that's 15 meters.
Yeah.
You're not even in a TV clip.
There was a video, what's the Barstool Sport? I think it was Barstool, one of those ones, did a thing where last year at the Boston Marathon, I may have it wrong. It's recently, and it's one of the big marathons, the guy set the all-time marathon world record. It was just over 2 minutes. And so they set a treadmill at the pace you would have to go for 2 full hours and said, all right, we're going to video these. Let's see how long you can go at this pace. Just average people. And people are flying off this thing after 15 seconds. It was a full dead-on sprint for 2 hours. And again, you don't realize how great these elite athletes are until you see them against someone who's not great, who's just me or you running against them or playing basketball. You know, look, I played basketball in high school. I was mediocre at best. I was tall, so I had that going for me. But I was a mediocre basketball player at best. But I have played. So throw me on for 1 minute of an NBA game. Not only am I not even in the right court because I'm constantly running behind because I'm so exhausted, I'm out of gas, but I would have, the minute I tried to do anything, the ball would be stripped off me or blocked. Like, I couldn't do anything. But you don't realize that because, again, when they're all on the court together, all NBA guys, they all are comparable.
Back to my sport, hockey.
Yeah.
The biggest thing you see when you get in training camp or early in the season, if we've got a junior B guy, or even a tier two junior A guy out with two guys that played in the American League, they can't handle the passes because the passes are so hard and so fast. It's like they can't get their stick down. So if you go in that NBA game and they make a pass to you, it's going to hit you in the chest and knock you down because you've never seen a ball come to you that fast. And they just play that way.
I'll tell you one more story, then we got to go here. But yes, a number of years ago, a colleague from the Spectator who shall remain nameless, there was a long snapper for the Ticats whose name is eluding me right now. I'll think of it in just a minute. But he was the best in the league at the time. And there was one snap in a game that went awry, and the Ticat kicker missed the field goal that cost them the game, and a bunch of people were on, you know, message boards or whatever saying, oh, he's a horrible snapper. He, you know, blew it. He blew it. Matt Robichaud was his name. And Robichaud was fantastic at it. He was just a genius at long snapping, as specific a task as that was, but he blew one. He had one mistake. And so the next day or the next practice, I was down at Ivor Wynne Stadium at that time. And I said, could you like fire one back to me? And let me see how.
As a punt or a.
No, for field goal. So you're about 7 yards deep from the guy.
You were going to be the holder.
I'm going to be the holder. And I'm about 7 yards deep. I'm on one knee as if I'm in that position. And he fired that thing back. And I swear, I was shocked at how fast that came back. I got my hands on it and I caught it, but it was lucky. Well, my colleague, who again will remain nameless, goes, all right, let me have a turn. He gets down into the position. And I swear, Don, he got his hands on it, but the point of that ball stopped 1 millimeter from his eye hole. It almost took his eye out. It was coming so fast. And you just have no idea. You just have no idea. And that's, you know, you can say, well, it's the CFL. Those guys are still great at that stuff. You have no idea how good these people are until you get on the field and realize, yeah, I'm hopeless. I don't know if Jake Paul knows something or just figures that he's 58. He can't be that strong anymore.
Paul's going to get paid a lot of money.
They're both going to probably be paid a lot of money. And I probably will tune in. I'm just noticing here. The good news is you may not have to pay for pay-per-view. It's going to be streamed globally on Netflix. How much you want to bet they get a billion people tuning in for that? All around the world. Everybody will be tuning in for that.
There'll be a billion people watching, maybe not all live. There'll be a lot of people
watching. You know what? I will watch. I will. I'll just be sucked into it.
When is it?
July the 20th. July the 20th. Mark it on your calendar. As our old friend Billy Red Lions would say, don't you dare miss it. And we got some encouraging news today that I thought was past the point of saving, but it appears Sports Illustrated has got a new deal and Sports Illustrated will not be dying. Sports Illustrated is going to still be published and there's still going to be a Sports Illustrated. Now, the reason I mention this is, of course, it is the granddaddy of sports magazines. It's the thing that everyone gets to, but if it's just Sports Illustrated for the name and none of the Sports Illustrated authors are involved, is it still Sports Illustrated?
No. No, it's not, because people buy it for the content. It's like many dads used to buy Playboy for the articles. In this case, it's more important. You're not buying it for the spectacular picture of a catch or a goal. You're buying it because of the content. And they had for years, decades, some of the superior sports writers.
Many, most.
And they only had to do a story a week. right? So you had a little time to do a really good job on a particular story. So what you, and I don't know, you asked me an opinion. I have an opinion on everything. But there's a pretty good chance that even some of the guys they had that lost their job that haven't found another job would come back for substantially less pay just to get a paycheck, right? So if somebody's making $250,000 a year because they're one of the top writers, might be pretty happy to make $90,000 and only do 2/3 of the stories. I don't know how they'll structure it, but it may in fact be different. And I would bet that Sports Illustrated, you know, in the last 20 years has changed a lot too, because as you know, in the media business and the print business, a lot of things are online.
Mm-hmm.
So you may be asked to do more than just your weekly story.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I don't know anything about it. The details have been pretty sparse, just that it's going to be coming back, which on the one hand is fantastic because, you know, as a kid, I mean, loved Sports Illustrated. That was, you waited every week for that thing to show up in your mailbox.
Well, Sports Illustrated, and let me go back to TV, when Mark Hebscher and Jim Taddy used to do Sportsline, yep, before there was a TSN or Sportsnet. And you could get a half an hour of sports. So if you were a sports junkie, you could see an awful lot, you know, versus Dick Bettos having 9 minutes on CHTV. You could get a whole half hour.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody looked forward to it. And that's what Sports Illustrated was, right? They were, then the sporting news come out, but things have changed so much.
Well, if Sports Illustrated did it, it mattered. Didn't matter what it was. If they covered it, especially if it was on the cover, but if you were in Sports Illustrated, and I was joking last hour about how I, once upon a time, for about 5 minutes on a resume, had said I was published in Sports Illustrated because I had a letter to the editor in there about Ben Johnson back in 88. But if you were published legitimately in Sports Illustrated, or if there was an article about your team or your organization or you, it was a big, big, big deal. I just don't know that you can recapture that if you don't have the guts of the operation. If it's just a bunch of Joe Schmoes and Sally Schmoes who are making $40,000 a year, not traveling and just writing stuff from their desk in New York, I don't know. It seems this is one of those things you've either got to invest in or not.
Well, you would think that if somebody's going to revive it, they think that they can do a better job and build a better mousetrap. But no matter who's buying it, the investment will be millions. Like, you're not firing that thing up for $400,000, I'm sure. Because you got to print it, you got to distribute it, and you have to do an awful lot of things. You won't have likely any subscribers right off the bat. But you would think that they would be in for the long haul and prepared to put some money into it before it goes whams up.
Unless the whole plan is, hey, we're just going to make whatever money we can on the swimsuit edition, and I'm not sure that's even working these days. But let's hope, because I mean, at its best, there legitimately was no better thing in sports than reading Sports Illustrated. I can't tell you how many hours I whiled away sitting in a bathroom reading Sports Illustrated. I hate to say that's where much of the reading was done, but
you would read every story.
Yeah.
Even if it was a sport that you probably didn't give a damn about.
Oh, yeah.
But you would read it because then you think, now I'm going to know more about this sport.
Yeah.
I don't understand cricket, but it's in Sports Illustrated, so it must be important. I'm going to learn about cricket, or at least read what they're talking about.
And you know, there were things that you learn about even from sports that you do watch that you knew nothing about. I hope that it is something more than just a name. I hope it's not an empty shell in a name, because again, at its best, this is the best thing that was out there. But
you would hope they wouldn't do that. You would think they wouldn't, but
well, we'll find out pretty soon, right? You're not going to be able to hide.
They're gonna have to bring some of the veteran guys back, but there's probably a bunch of good young storytellers and columnists out there and reporters out there that maybe it gives it a fresh look and it's equally as interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, let's hope. I mean, the other thing about it that they can, the Sports Illustrated cover, I see, if I'm the Sports Illustrated people, what I'm doing right off the bat is trying to create this social media buzz again about the Sports Illustrated jinx. Get some buzz going that, you know, people don't remember this. If you were on the cover of Sports Illustrated, you were doomed. Something bad was going to happen to you. And there was a litany. There's a long laundry list of examples.
Like the Red Sox are hot and they put their Roger Clemens on the cover of it.
Yeah, NHL is hot, NBA is cold, and then the NHL promptly goes on strike. You know, the other one I remember is when Joe Carter and I can't remember what else his name was.
Elmer?
No. When they were still with the Cleveland Indians, about how the Indians were going to win the whole thing, and I think they finished last in the league that year. It was just
there's probably a website that captures most.
You know what? I'm going to look it up. Don Robertson, thanks for coming in today. Always appreciate it.
All right, Scott.
The Scott Radley Show, weekday evenings from 6 to 8 on 900 CHML.
The Scott Radley Show podcast is available on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Scott Radley. Thanks again for listening, and do not forget to subscribe to this podcast. It is free. You will never miss an episode. And also, be sure you rate us and review us. Whatever you think of us, we'll take it. Thanks for listening.
Canada may be known for its landscapes and friendly people, but beneath the surface lies a darker side of crime, history, and the paranormal. Since 2017, the award-winning Dark Poutine podcast has explored the shadowy corners of the Great White North and beyond, delivering chilling tales from a uniquely Canadian perspective. Hosted by Mike Brown and Matthew Stockton, with over 300 episodes and fresh releases every Monday, Dark Poutine is your weekly ticket to the creepier side of Canada. Listen to Dark Poutine on Apple, Spotify, Amazon Music, or wherever you get your podcasts.